everybody. Welcome to another Comic Boom Comic Source collaboration. It's your DC Spotlight for April 9th, 2024. Here with Rocky to talk about the DC books this week. Really quick before we dive into that, I do want to mention the passing of Mark Bright, MD Bright, Doc Bright. So Mark Doc Bright. I don't know why his nickname was Doc. I never did find that out. But this man was my favorite Iron Man artist of all time. He did tons of work on a lot of properties. He had a long run on Green Lantern as well. People know him from Quantum and Woody. Just by all accounts, I never had the chance to meet him, but by all accounts, this guy was just beloved by everybody. He had a really sharp, sarcastic sense of humor, and it's a real loss. I think he was like super, super talented. So the news came down about his passing while we were recording last Monday, actually this episode, this podcast, and I forgot to mention it. So I did want to mention it. He was one of my favorite artists. One of the first artists whose style I recognized. And it's just too bad.
Yeah, and I think it's worth noting too the passing of Ed Piskor. Ed Piskor. I know that. I hate the word suicide, but I've had it in my family, and it's a horrible thing to experience. And my prayers and blessings go out to Ed Piskor's family, and sort of an unfortunate byproduct of cancel culture and his own unfortunate state of mind. And it's just really tragic. He was it's just a really terrible story. So it's just hate when we have to sort of we have some tragedies like that. If you're feeling down and out, guys, buy comic books and try to cheer yourself up somehow, whether it's reading a comic or talking to a friend or call a hotline number. But it's just it's a terrible thing. But in any event, you and I will talk about better things now, because we will rant and rave, because we certainly have things to rant and certainly rave about this week.
Yeah, 100%. And I'll just kind of add my condolences to Ed's family as well. We're not weighing in on the circumstances or whatever. We don't know what happened. We may never know. Yeah. It doesn't matter. Someone's lost their life. It's a sad thing. So hopefully cooler heads will prevail, and things like that can be prevented in the future. I mean, we do this because we love comics. Nobody, I don't care what they tell you. Nobody has ever gotten into comics because they said, hey, I want to get rich. I want to get rich. I'm going to become a comic book creator. No, people get into it because they love it, because they love the art. They love the medium. And there's a passion there. And it's just too bad when things like this happen. So as Rocky said, we'll dive into the books this week. Overall, I thought it was a pretty good week. We got the big event kicking off in Action Comics of Brainiac. We have the end of Speed Force, maybe thankfully. Some really great books. So when the first issue of Suicide Squad Dream Team came out, I gave it my book of the week. I was really impressed with what writer Nicole Maines did. We have the second issue out this week. Nicole is still handling the writing duties. Pencils by Eddie Barrows. Inks by Eber Ferreira. Colors by Adriana Lucas. Letters by Becca Carey. And it's interesting. We know, obviously, it's Suicide Squad, so Amanda Waller is going to have a big role. But what I find interesting is we didn't see this on the trade dress of the first issue, but on the trade dress of issue 2, above the title Suicide Squad Dream Team is a little banner, Countdown to Absolute Power, which we know Absolute Power is the event that's coming up this year for DC in the summer, where Amanda Waller manages to take all the powers of the superhero, of metahumans. I shouldn't say superheroes, of metahumans, right? She takes the powers of superheroes as well as supervillains. When we had Nicole on a few months ago to talk about this, maybe 6 weeks ago, she mentioned wanting to kind of examine Amanda Waller a little bit. And, we have certainly talked a lot about Amanda Waller. You cannot spotlight DC Comics and not talk about Amanda Waller. And I've mentioned so many times how she's just become like this plot device to just move things along for writers. She seems to know everything and have her fingers in everything and show up wherever she needs to show up, whether that be on Earth 3 or Earth Prime or whatever, with no explanation. Nothing's ever explained. And we've gotten so far away from who Amanda Waller was in the beginning when she was created by John Ostrander. I think in the Legends miniseries is where she showed up first, and then the Suicide Squad series that spun out after that. And I've even said, in a way, in my mind, she's a little bit of a flawed character, certainly a product of her time, you know, coming out of the late 1980s. You know, this very much a stereotype of this overweight, angry black woman who gets along with nobody and yells a lot. Gotten away from that sort of stereotype in terms of what her body looks like, maybe due to the casting of Amanda Waller in the Green Lantern movie, as much as that was terrible. I think it was Angela Bassett was cast as her, who's very thin. But either way, it doesn't matter. She's still a plot device. She still has kind of, she's all knowing. She can stand up to all these super, it doesn't make sense. She's almost worse than the Joker in a lot of ways in terms of what a cliche she's become. So all that being said, I appreciate what Nicole's trying to do to add some context and add some explanation of maybe why Amanda does what she does. And it gets sort of meta. And again, I really appreciate that. When there's this dream sequence where Dreamer enters Amanda's dream and Amanda's, you know, we're reminded of some of the trauma that she went through early in her career when she's a young woman with family stuff and what have you. And Dreamer's there and says, you know, I'm not buying any of this. You don't even believe what you're doing. You know, this whole idea of you got to break some eggs to make an omelet or whatever. Like it's at the end of the day, it's all bull crap. She's gone way, way too far. And she's just that same old tired cliche that she rolled. I'm just trying to make the world a safer place. Well, if you kill 5 million people to save a million people, guess what, Amanda? That's not a good trade-off. Maybe this is a poor analogy, but because it's kind of my day job or whatever, I'm kind of in the corporate world. I see it all the time, right? I see all the time where businesses will spend a dollar to save a dime. I see it all the time. That's Amanda Waller. She spends a dollar to save a dime. Like nobody's buying it anymore. And I'm glad that, you know, maybe I kind of wish it would have a little more widespread instead of being Dreamer, who's not really that well known, saying it in an Amanda Waller dream. I want like Superman or Batman or Wonder Woman shouting it from, you know, the highest place in Metropolis or Gotham City or whatever. Amanda Waller's a piece of crap. You know, say the quiet thing out loud. She says that she wants to make the world a safer place, but she does more harm than she does good. And that's the bottom line. Maybe she started out with the right intentions, but in my mind, she's never been on the right track, and she's certainly gone off the rails in the last decade or so. But again, I've said it a ton lately. Hopefully with this absolute power thing, we can get her off the board at least for a year or two and just stop having her show up constantly. Because I don't enjoy reading about her. And at the end of the day, she has just become this plot device. So again, I'm not faulting the creative team. I think the art is fantastic, as it always is with Eddie Barrows and Iber Ferreira. I think Nicole's doing, you know, the best she can with what she was given. I still enjoy the voices that she's given the characters, whether it be Clock King or Harley Quinn or Dreamer, even to some extent, Amanda Waller herself. But I don't think, and I do find it interesting that DC trusts Nicole enough to be the one writing this. That does say a lot about the talent that she has, I think. But it needs to be more, right? Like too much has happened with Amanda Waller over the last 5 years, I would say, especially for somebody even of Nicole's talent level to come in and write this and kind of in a way make us understand Amanda Waller and kind of, okay, I don't agree with her, but I understand where she's coming from. You can do that. And those are the best villains, you know, like I think of Toyo Harada over at Valiant. He's one. We talked recently about Poison Ivy. Just last week, we talked about Poison Ivy and kind of the modernization of her origin by G. Willow Wilson, where we can understand why Pamela Isley makes the choices that she makes, and it makes for kind of a more complicated and more nuanced and a more relatable character. I don't think you can fix Amanda Waller. It's been too much for too long, over and over and over, for anybody, you know, and it's not, again, a knock against Nicole. I don't think anybody, could do it. And the other part is kind of the wonky continuity or the lack of continuity that we've had, in the DC universe lately. And it's been mentioned, right? Like, I think in a recent issue of Wonder Woman, Wonder Woman herself said, yeah, Amanda Waller's back from Earth 3. Nobody knows how or why, but she's back. Even the writers at DC, I won't name any names, but I've had writers at DC go, yeah, she's back and I'm told I need to use her in my book, but nobody can explain why she, where or when or how she came back from Earth 3.
Yeah.
Cause I think they kind of didn't care, but now that it's been mentioned in books, it's mentioned in this issue of Suicide Squad, I think it will be addressed, a little more clearly. The implication is this, whatever the crew is that Amanda Waller was talking to at the end of Dark Crisis on Infinite Earths, that, what was it called? The Light Council or Council of Light or whatever.
Yeah, I think so. Something like that. Yeah.
So the implication of what I've been told is they brought her back from Earth 3, but why? She had her own Justice League there. She was basically the ruler of Earth 3. Why did she come back? But that supposedly that's why she's indebted to them. So, you know, again, I don't know how well it'll be explained or when or if it'll be explained. I think it will. But whether or not it's going to make any sense is another story altogether. And whether it needs to make sense, I don't know. But it's just too bad that this issue is really taken over by Waller, because although obviously she was in last issue, she wasn't the focus. And I enjoyed last issue more than this issue. But again, no knock against the creative team. I think they're doing the best with kind of what's required of them. And I do continue to think Nicole's giving great voices, great dialogue, great scripting, and it's well paced to this Suicide Squad story. So I'm looking forward to Absolute Power for the reasons I stated before. I hope it gets Amanda Waller out of the pages of my comics at least for a little while. We'll wait and see. So anyway, what were your thoughts on this issue, Rocky?
Well, I think that. I think generally speaking, DC has done a really terrible job with Amanda Waller, because I'm not sure if we're supposed to think that, is this all misdirection? Is Amanda Waller being brainwashed? Because honestly, if you told me that Amanda Waller is being brainwashed because she used to be a control freak, but now she's 100% pure evil, you don't go from, there's lots of control freaks. There's a difference between Amanda Waller wanting to control the situation and have power versus wanting to, you know, frankly, engage with Brainiac and Failsafe and take over the planet and essentially lead to the killing and putting every hero, putting a hit on every hero for the villain and issuing pardons and all the stuff that they made her do. It's so complete. It's just not consistent with her past character. So if you were to tell me that A, she's mind control, B, it's a transition, I don't care. They haven't set anything up. They've just had Amanda Waller do this, do that, do this, do that, and just show up here be your usual asshole self, bitch self. Show up here, be your bitch self. Show up here, have an argument with your nephew, Deadeye. Show up here, have an argument with so-and-so. Show up here, talk with, show up in Teen Titans and in Titans and have an argument with whatever, not Necron, but the devil, what the hell is his name? Doesn't matter. It just, she's all over the place. And then I'm not even sure what the assignment for Nicole Maines is. Nicole Maines does a decent job here of Amanda Waller's. I don't know how to read this issue. Is Amanda Waller, is she actually struggling? Is there an actual part of Amanda Waller that cares about her nephew? I don't know. Maybe there is, maybe there isn't. It can read both ways. And because it can read both ways to me, because it's Amanda Waller, it just annoys me. I don't enjoy reading it. It annoys me. And then is Amanda Waller supposed to be torn? I mean, at one point at the end of this issue, she starts taking pills to keep herself awake because she doesn't want to fall asleep because Dreamer will enter her dreams and try to make her feel guilty again. And she doesn't want to think about family. She doesn't want to think about, I guess she just wants to stick on her mission. That leads me to believe that maybe she is being manipulated by Brainiac. And Brainiac has told her, you have to do this, or I'll do this, or I do that. And so maybe Brainiac showed up and is manipulating Amanda Waller. Maybe that's the play. But if that's the play, DC hasn't done a good job of setting it up prior to that. And frankly, that's the most important thing, because we all know that the most important thing when it comes to big events or is the villain. I mean, so is this DC's way of saying, well, the more important villains are Brainiac and Failsafe? Amanda Waller, I guess she's clearly the third wheel in that whole thing, but maybe she isn't. But they've done it. They haven't done a good job of really of propping her up, other than just making her, like you say, she is just a bitch, and she's kind of a she is. I hate to say it. You were being very polite, but I'll be less polite. She is the big, fat, angry black woman. And she kind of fits the stereotype in a multitude and a myriad of ways. And, you know, you could accuse me of being stereotypical in that respect. But, hey, I'm just reading it out of the comic. And she doesn't get along with her husband. You know, check. Black woman that doesn't get along with her husband, leaves her husband. Check. I'm sorry. These are all cliche stereotypical representations. I mean, if you really want to get into the weeds here. And doesn't get along with her nephew, you know. Is a woman in a man's world, so now she's even more of a control freak. So now it's just the whole thing just seems so awful. And then at the end, who's going to feel sorry for Amanda Waller if it's revealed that Brainiac is brainwashing her? I'm still not going to feel sorry for her at all. I'm just not, because they've done a very bad job of establishing this character. And Nicole Maines has an impossible task. She does a reasonably, I don't know how. You could have Jeff Johns doing this and you'd fail, because it's Amanda Waller. And in any event,
let me play devil's advocate just for a second, though, Rocky. Okay. Maybe, I mean, we have strong reactions to her. And I mean, that's the point of art, right? And the point of story, that we do have emotional reaction. But maybe that's the point. Maybe DC wants a character that people just hate. The worst thing is people just don't care, right? They don't care, then they won't pick up the books or whatever.
Yeah, that's true.
I don't enjoy reading Amanda Waller, but I got to admit that when I read stories about her, it triggers a response. I have a visceral response.
We should have a trigger warning.
Yeah, right? And it's been time and time again with social media that people are much more likely to respond and actually put stuff on social media when something angers them, or they have something to bitch about. Then they do something that makes them happy. Like, it just makes you happy and you go about your day. But when you piss off about something, you know, you go through the drive-thru at Burger King or whatever and they get your hamburger wrong, that's when you're going to post, right? You're going to, Burger King, you can't get anything done. If they make your hamburger correctly, you don't say anything. You just move on with your day. So maybe it's DC being brilliant, right? Maybe it's DC being brilliant. Here we are kicking off the podcast. We've talked about Amanda Waller for 10 minutes. Maybe we're being snowballed by DC. DC has Amanda Waller exactly where they want her, because it's engendering conversation.
Yeah, well, we'll see. I mean, I hope maybe this will be a bang. Maybe Absolute Power will be the event that will, I will happily put my foot in my mouth, and I got no problem being having my worst expectations proven wrong. So we shall see. But in fairness, I didn't even talk about some of the plot points here. I think the art's fantastic. I think Nicole Maines has done a reasonably good job of making me doubt Amanda Waller, that maybe Amanda Waller is a pawn. Why would Amanda Waller even worry about, why does she need to stay awake? Why does she care if she falls asleep and dream or reads her mind again? Why would she care if she's in control all the time? And so I will give Nicole Maines this was a rare moment of vulnerability of Amanda Waller that we haven't seen all that much. And so I'll give her that. And it's making me doubt, well, maybe Amanda Waller is a pawn in this Absolute Power as well. And maybe there's kinks in this armor. And maybe there's more to the story of how she came from Earth 3 that is yet to be revealed, particularly when you say that there's other writers that maybe were not told, and other DC writers haven't even been told exactly what the big reveal is here. Maybe there's something going on behind the scenes regarding Amanda Waller that will sort of redeem my general hostility toward how she's been handled over the last year. So fingers crossed. So.
Yeah, fingers crossed. I will say that I've said before, if a writer could tell the right story, I possibly could become a Joker fan. I just don't ever see, like you mentioned, she's been brainwashed, whatever. You made the point, like even if we find out she's been controlled, I'm still going to hate Amanda Waller. I just am. It doesn't matter. I'm never going to feel bad for her. I'm never going to, like, that would be like the impossible task. I just don't think anybody can ever write a story that would make me like Amanda Waller. Anyway, let's move on. The Batman First Night, Book 2, written by Dan Jurgens, art and cover by Mike Perkins, colors by Mike Spicer, letters by Simon Boland. Wow, is this an incredible book. It's so amazing. I love it so much. you know, the first one really impressed me. It was such a blast to talk to Dan Juergens, who's been on the show before. Mike Perkins, we had him on for the first time ever to talk about what they were trying to accomplish. It was a great look behind the scenes in terms of, yes, this is Black Label, but just based on kind of the nature of Golden Age stories, where there wasn't a lot of detail, wasn't a lot of stuff fleshed out and what have you, storytelling just wasn't as complex back there. Nothing that's happening in this book, nothing that's happening in this series, according to Dan and Mike, is going to contradict anything that happened in Batman's, you know, first few months as Batman. So this could totally fit into canon. I love the feel. I love the kind of inexperienced feeling that we have with Bruce Wayne. You know, other stories have tried to do it before. Obviously, the one that's most well-known would be Frank Miller and David Mazzucchelli's Batman Year One, right? The four-part Year One story that's critically acclaimed that appeared in the regular Batman title. I think it was issues 401 through 404. But again, that was in the mid-80s, a more kind of modern retelling. The timing, probably 80s as well, when it was set. But this is going back to the actual time that Batman first appeared, right? So late 1930s, and dealing with the politics of that time. You have the Nazism movement gaining power in Europe. You have the United States trying to recover from the Great Depression. You have the Art Deco period of architecture and what have you that Mike Perkins talked about with design. Just so many things that are coming together. And this art team, this creative team, they're doing such a fantastic job of capturing the feel of that time. And like I said, in a way, it was a more innocent time, but at the same time, that doesn't mean things were better. There was a huge amount of poverty. Racism was still rampant, discrimination, gender discrimination, that sort of thing. So yeah, there was a lot of political upheaval at that time as well. I mentioned, you know, the rise of Nazism in Europe going on at this time. And, you know, unfortunately, as I spoke to Dan about when he was on the podcast recently, a lot of those same sort of problems are, you know, rearing their ugly head again, white supremacy and what have you now, which, God, it's almost 100 years later. We haven't progressed. God, it's kind of frustrating when you think about it. But that's what's one of the great things about this book, right? Like you take all that sort of realistic socio-political setting and context, and you put Batman there in his earliest days trying to learn to be Batman with fantastic gritty line work from Mike Perkins, gorgeous colors from Mike Spicer, and Mike Perkins, he even talked about, you know, this is the Black Label format, so a little bit bigger, and he talked about, yeah, it's great, I have more room on the page, but at the same time, I have more room on the page. Like, it's a double-edged sword. But I thought the art, it was fantastic. And you feel like it's a big chunk of story. Like, when you read it, it's like, not every time I turn the page, but frequently when I turn, I'm like, oh, it feels like, you know, just based on the rhythm of a comic and how long a comic typically lasts, I'm probably getting close to the end. But no, it keeps going because it's like 48 pages. So it's over double the size of a you know, regular 20-page comic. So I can't say enough good things about this. Like, it as much as I'm like, man, enough with the Batman. We know it's the engine that drives DC. We know it's the IP that pays the bills at Warner Brothers. But when you get stories like this, right, that feel, even though it's set way back in his earliest days, it still feels fresh. And it still feels exciting, and you still have a desire to read the next issue. You can't wait to see what's going to happen next. You put quality veteran comic creators and give them the freedom to tell the story they want to tell, which is what Black Label is supposed to be. You have the potential to have a fantastic comic, and that's what this is. It's just a fantastic comic. And the last thing I'll mention is, in terms of being those early days, like if you go back and look at images of Batman from, you know, Detective 27 or what have you, how much his head looks like a bat. Like, the ears aren't just straight up. They're kind of off to the side. His head looks more round, like an actual bat. And Mike Perkins captures that really well in the costume design. And when there's a scene where Bruce Wayne goes down into his cave and opens up the little chamber where he has his background. Because remember, this is before Alfred even. Because Alfred was added after, which I know it doesn't make you know, a lot of sense trying to think about it too much, because, you know, he raised Bruce and he should have been there or whatever, but he wasn't actually introduced until a few years into the run, kind of retconned in. So anyways, Batman goes down there, he opens it up, there's his costume, and yeah, it looks like a bat. It looks like emphasis bat instead of the man. So I'm just loving this. I can't say enough good things about how great the series has been so far. What about you, Rocky? Are you enjoying it?
I am, yeah. The Mike Perkins art, I'm enjoying the art a little bit more than the story. I do think this story does seem a little bit, just a tad long-winded, I think. But I'm very forgiving of that. And it might sound nitpicky, but I'm very forgiving of that only because it gives Mike Perkins a chance to show off his art. I actually believe this, the substance of the plot that moved forward in this issue could have been told with fewer pages, but I don't care. I'll pay a little bit more because of Mike Perkins' art. I mean, that's what it comes down to. And it really is. It shines as a black label. And there's a lot of sexiness here. I love the time period, and I like the sexiness of this Julie character, the potential love interest for Bruce Wayne. I think it's really good. And I don't know, you nailed it on the costume. This Batman looks distinctly different, and he does look like, it does look like a Batman that would, that's probably how Batman would look in the early 1940s, or, you know, 1939-ish at the beginning of World War II. Yeah, and it has a horror element to it he's fighting gangsters, and this is a Batman. He doesn't like to use guns, and at one point it actually ends with Batman considering the use of using guns, and of course this is right at the hallmark, or at least at the tail end of the 1930s, which is the hallmark of the height of the gangster movement and what have you. This is a decade after the end of Prohibition, and this is visceral. It's eye catching, and I'm looking forward, because we only have the digital copies. I'm very much looking forward to as I was the first issue, looking at going through the pages and just turning the pages and reading it a second time, which I actually got more out of the first issue when I read it a second time. And this issue too is the same thing. There's a lot of bang for your buck here visually, and the story is not that complicated to follow. And I'm actually curious to see where it goes, because the Gregory Peck, I mean, that's the actor I was trying to think of. I don't know if I said that character's name or actor, or if you did last time, but the Bruce Wayne looks like Gregory Peck. This does not look like a typical Bruce Wayne to me that I'm used to seeing, and that's what I like. I note that some other reviewers were a little bit more harsh on the first issue for the very same reasons that you and I enjoyed it, because it, you know, they felt that it wasn't as familiar as they would like. But I like the unfamiliarity of this, but just enough. This is like a nice, an Elseworlds tale that even when this is over, I would have no problem revisiting this era of Batman, this iteration of Batman in the future. So two issues in, and I think there's it's three issues long, isn't it?
I thought it was four. Let me double check on that. One of the things I noticed, and it's maybe it's kind of silly, but you mentioned his love interest, what have you. When they were in the kitchen of Wayne Manor, the kitchen in Wayne Manor, it looks just like the kitchen in Wayne Manor in the Flash movie. Like, I don't know, Mike Perkins, we've seen the kitchen a few other times in some other live action, and it's been kind of big and sprawling or what have you. But
right,
obviously in the Flash movie, when they go into the kitchen the first time, it's kind of like run down and.
You're right. It is. Yeah. It is the same kitchen.
Yeah. The fact that it's Bruce Wayne living in this giant mansion all by himself, probably not even cooking any meals. The kitchen looks kind of run down, just like it did in the Flash movie. I noticed that right off the bat. I was like, huh. Kind of interesting. You're right. Three issues for this. So I'm going to be sad to see this one end, man. I'm enjoying it so much. All right. I'm really curious to hear what you have to say about this next book. Saying the quiet part out loud. Bird Planetary is actually showing up. We have way more than that, even in Outsiders. Issue number 6, written by Jackson Lansing and Colin Kelly. Robert Carey art, Valentina Tadeo on colors, and Tom Napolitano on letters. I've really been enjoying this, but I've said all along that I've never read Planetary, so I don't have that context. You've been a little more critical because you can't help but compare it to Planetary, which was kind of groundbreaking and critically acclaimed at the time. And as I said, in this issue, we find out Drummer is actually a character from Planetary, and there's the reference to the shape of reality as a snowflake, which is something that was originally presented by Warren Ellis in Planetary as well. So yeah, the quiet part out loud, this basically is an update of Planetary from DC, who obviously owns Planetary since they bought Wildstorm. So yeah, you, as I said, know a lot more about Planetary than me. So give us your thoughts on this one.
Well, I just want to be clear. You don't need to know. I've been going up and down on this series. Last issue, my opinion varied drastically from yours, because I thought it was by far the worst issue of the series and the worst issue of the week, I thought. From art to story to lettering, it was a trifecta of disaster, I thought. But I could understand where it was going. This is a... now I read this issue and I'm really intrigued. And I said this before, I've said this in a number of these issues before that we reviewed, that maybe this is the comic book that everyone should be reading and leading into the big event in September that DC's leading to. Because we got Jenny Crisis, we got a reference to the Crisis, we got a reference to a narrative singularity in previous issues. We already know that they're sort of archaeologists of the unknown. But in this issue, in a nutshell, what it's basically been revealed is that Jaquita Wagner, who is one of the members of the original Planetary, she's actually the new Drummer here. And she looks like Jaquita Wagner. And I thought it was when I first saw The Outsiders in the first issue, but I figured, it's all misdirection. That was one of my complaints. Why did they make Drummer look like Jaquita Wagner? It looks ridiculous. It looks like an older Jaquita Wagner, and it actually is. So, okay, there's that. But now they're Lucius Fox is narrating this issue, and 14 months ago, something happens. Lucius Fox discovered something, and that's why he put together the Outsiders team consisting of Luke Fox's son, Jaquita Wagner, and of course, Kate Kane, who is Batwoman. And they're part of this carrier, and the carrier can travel through the bleed and manifest itself at any point in the multiverse of things. And there is this snowflake which represents the multiverse and represents the true shape of reality. And what they ended up getting sort of sucked into here is a narrative singularity, where as soon as they get into the narrative singularity, it's so meta. This issue is so meta, it's incredible. They're in a landmark final issue. They end up in a fictional world, I think it's fictional, maybe it's real, where all the canceled characters go. All the characters of canceled series go. We meet all kinds of canceled characters. Cave Carson. I know, because I was one of the 12 people that actually bought his series 4 years ago before it was canceled. You know, we got Zariel. We got Richard Dragon. And we got anybody that's a victim of a crisis or a cancellation ends up in this other world, and they lose their powers. Kate Kane, Batwoman, and Lucius Fox, they end up talking to various characters in this sort of series in this world, and all these characters, they're there and they can't escape and they don't have their powers. So if you're a character that's been killed off and you until such time as you're resurrected, this, you live in this narrative singularity where you might be called upon at some future point, or you might never be called upon. And now, what's the point of all this? Well, frankly, I don't know. I'm a little frustrated. But we know that Jaquita Wagner, the Drummer, she's really pissed off, because she ends up confronting Richard Dragon. And Richard Dragon says to her, you know what? I don't know why you guys are here. I don't know why anybody comes here. The best thing is you might as well just leave us alone and let us die. Best thing is let things die. And this makes Jaquita Wagner, the Drummer, extremely angry. She lashes out, and she apparently hasn't lost her powers. And what I find very interesting about that is that clearly Jaquita Wagner, she reveals, she doesn't, it angers her because she doesn't want things to die. Now, that might go without saying, but to be clear here, something is happening in the multiverse. Something odd is going. In last issue, they were looking for a place between the pages. This, I think, is the place between the pages. So if you think of a comic book, think very meta. They're in this place that is the landmark final issue. And there's no answers. One of the frustrating things that they discover here is that there's no answers. Yet, this is the landmark final issue. If we're breaking meta and we're thinking meta, well, there's nothing more frustrating than when we read a landmark final issue, Jace, and we don't get the answers. Well, that's what happens here. Well, they're in a landmark final issue narrative singularity, and there's no answers provided to them. Now, that's very frustrating. So as a reader, I mean, it's kind of comical, but I bitch about that all the time, and so do you. Nothing worse than getting to a final issue and we don't get any answers. That's frustrating. But that's also something I think we're supposed to get from this, that as frustrated as we readers can be with a final issue that gives us no answers, the outsiders are frustrated because they get no answers trapped within this narrative singularity. They're allowed to escape. They essentially escape because they still have their powers. And so they're capable of escaping, and they shouldn't actually be there. They're just visiting. And then that's when Jaquita Wagner tells the truth, and she says, because Batwoman forces her to tell the truth, because the Batwoman sort of the carrier manifests as a female in this narrative singularity and gets very friendly with Batwoman, and the carrier reveals to Batwoman who the drummer really is, Jaquita Wagner, former member of the original Planetary. And Jaquita Wagner does say, she goes that, I've, while you might think I've shown up in your story, you've actually always been in mine, which leads me to believe that the DC universe is actually within the story of Planetary. So maybe the DC universe, which has gone through all kinds of crisis, from death metal to dark crisis to all kinds of nonsense, maybe it's affected the Planetary's universe, and Jaquita Wagner is the key to maybe making a new DC universe or the ultimate DC universe. This is me speculating, but I'm trying to understand what the point of this series is. This is a real cool issue in terms of how it breaks the fourth wall. There's all kinds of symbolism here and all kinds of symbolism that I could talk for longer on, but I won't. Suffice to say, it's interesting, you know, does our story overlap with the Planetary story? How and why? Why should we care? I don't know. That's the big reveal, though. This is not about being archaeologists of history, which is akin to Planetary. It's more about Jaquita Wagner, who is a former member of the original Planetary, trying to solve a mystery involving our universe being part of her universe, in some massive mystery that Lucius Fox felt it was so important to address that he put together this team. But what are they? Is this narrative singularity, is this actually a threat that the mainstream DC universe needs to worry about? Because the last time we had a narrative singularity or a threat that broke the fourth wall, it was the vampiric monitor in Final Crisis and in Batman Beyond, that Superman had to fight because he was eating up all the stories in the multiverse, and Superman won by basically giving everyone, not only defeating the vampiric monitor who was eating up all the narratives in the story, but he gave everyone a happy ending. And that's symbolized in Final Crisis at the end of Batman Beyond, where Superman's gravestone reads, "To be continued," meaning that the story never ends. So it's very cool. So that's very meta. So I think that Lansing and Kelling here are doing their best to access their inner Grant Morrison. While it's not as good as Grant Morrison, I do actually think they did actually not a bad job here. God damn, they got my curiosity. But where the hell is this going? And nobody's talking about this series. And maybe we should. But I'm frustrated because I think that there's a gem of a story here. But I'm not really sure if I'm right about that. I don't know. What do you think about it? I bottom line is, I like this. I like this issue. And I'm not sure, maybe I should love it, but I really liked it. What did you think?
Yeah, well, I mean, like I said, it really hits you over the head with, yeah, it's Planetary. And I know how complicated that story is, and I've never read it and what have you. So But like you mentioned, it's not like I'm missing out on anything because I haven't read Planetary. Like, I'm still enjoying this. At times I've enjoyed it more than you. So I think the bones of a great story are there. But, you know, being that it's a little bit more of a complicated story, it's pulling in so many different mysteries. And I think it's purposely being a little bit vague. And, you know, again, in the realities of the market, you're going to do a 12-issue series. It's going to be broken down into two trades. Great way to end the first trade, to leave it on a bit of a cliffhanger. So hopefully people come back and pick up the second one. So I'm really enjoying it. I feel like the big reveal, the context of the story, what is this about? What is it that Lucius saw? What is he trying to prevent? What is ultimately going to be the goal of the Outsiders? That's all yet to be revealed. So I'm really excited to find out what that's going to be, beyond just the name, you know, Outsiders, which has a history in DC, but these are truly outsiders. I mean, not only are they kind of working outside the law, working outside of what might be on people's radars, also on the superhero community's radar, but maybe outside the lines of reality itself. So, you know, never has the term or the team name Outsiders been more appropriate, perhaps, than with this team. And part of the reason that I enjoy it so much is I like these characters. I've really been enjoying the character of Drummer, who turns out to be Jaquita Wagner. I love Batwoman. I love Luke Fox. Lucius Fox, I'm hot or cold on him. Really needs to give Bruce his money back, is all I really think about when I hear the name Luke Fox, or Lucius Fox, rather. but for the most part, I enjoy all these characters. And I'm big fans of Jackson and Colin. I think they're very underrated as a writing team. So anyway, yeah, I am really enjoying it. I thought the art was really strong in this one as well. So yeah, pick it up if you're so inclined. Okay, up next we have Batman Dylan Dog number 2, story and script by Roberto Recchioni, Gigi Cavanaugho, and Werther Del Edra handle the art, Giovanni Nero on colors, Pat Brosso on letters. The majority of this team being Italian. Dylan Dog, as we mentioned when we talked about the first issue, is a very well-known Italian comic book character. But I love what Roberto Recchioni is doing here in kind of mixing the Batman and DC mythos with Dylan Dog. And he also has a great sense of humor as well. Although this is a serious story about one of Dylan Dog's nemeses and the Joker, one of Batman's nemeses, teaming up. And, you know, they're very formidable and very dangerous or what have you. There's still time for humor. And once they've realized that it may be another of Dylan Dog's villains or nemesis that the Joker is really after, this guy named Christopher Kelex, who was a serial killer, maybe rivaling the Joker in terms of depravity. When they find that out, the next thing is to figure out, okay, well, did the Joker – so the Joker went to team up with this Kelex guy, found out he was dead, which apparently is a well-known Dylan Dog story. And then he changes to looking for Dr. Zabraxas or whatever his name is, so that he can use the Joker can use Dr. Zabaris, I think is how you say it actually. Zabaris is this formula he has to raise the dead, to hopefully bring Kelex back to life, right? So once they find that out, okay, they got to find out, did it work? Was Christopher Kelex resurrected? Well, in order to do that, they have to go to hell and find out, is Christopher Kelex still in hell? Well, who better to go and find out than to go and recruit John Constantine? But what I love is when Batman says that, because first they go to this fortune teller or this medium who can speak to the dead, and they ask her, and she goes, oh, well, if I can't tell you if he's there or not, because if he is, he's way down deep in hell, and that's, you know, farther than I'm willing to go. That's too risky. And so they leave, and Dylan Dog is like, I guess that wasn't the best idea. And Batman's like, no, you, that was a good idea. We just need to find somebody with the same abilities as this medium who's got less scruples. And Dylan Dog's like, well, do you know someone like that? He goes, I do, and so do you. And Dylan's like, oh, no, not him. And immediately, as readers, you know exactly who it is, right?
Yeah.
And sure enough, on the next panel, we see John Constantine pass out on the floor in a pool of his own vomit, you know, as you would expect John Constantine to be. And it's just fantastic. And the rest of the issue is Dylan Dog and Constantine playing off each other, going to hell, trying to find out if Kill-X is still there or not. They have a really interesting conversation about kind of the different generations, baby boomers versus Gen Z or Gen X, which is really interesting in the context of Piccadilly Square. And a really interesting philosophical conversation that we could have a podcast about all on its own, just that one little conversation. I thought that brought a lot to the story and really interesting. And then once they get to hell, there's this fantastic moment where they're kind of going back and forth about hell and if people deserve to go to hell and that sort of thing. And after John Constantine sort of gives his opinion, my favorite line of the whole issue, probably of the whole series so far, is when Dylan Dog says, you know, John, if it weren't for your personality, your behavior, the things you do and the things you'd say, he'd be a great guy. And John just kind of shrugs. He's like, who gives a shit, right? And they go on their way. But yeah, that had me laughing out loud. It was just hilarious. I don't know how much DC Roberto Recchioni reads, but he's got a good handle on these characters, whether it be the Demon or John Constantine or Batman himself. He does a fantastic job of really giving us some what feels like some accurate characterization. So I think it's fantastic. I enjoying it immensely so far. The art and the coloring very much suit the tone of the story. And yeah, I'm a big fan of this. It's second issue was even better than the first. And I thought the first issue was really great. So what are your thoughts on it, Rocky?
This is my first exposure to Dylan Dog other than the first issue of this series. And Dylan Dog, you know, nightmare investigator, nightmare hunter or whatever he is. Interesting as hell. And it was what I found was very interesting here is how writer Roberto Recchioni drew distinctions between John Constantine and Dylan Dog. And it was very helpful toward me and how Dylan Dog is, as he describes John Constantine, as sort of an older guy who's cynical about the present generation, how the older generation is always better than the new. And I thought it was very interesting how he had John Constantine's state to Dylan. We once wore hell on our own bodies like a filthy coat, but now we hide it behind our social media profiles. And Dylan, of course, which is kind of funny, Dylan is more optimistic about this generation, about the present generation than Constantine is, which, and Dylan is probably not particularly an optimistic guy to begin with because he's a nightmare hunter. But Constantine, of course, he's the most cynical bastard you could imagine. And like you so aptly pointed out, one of the best lines in there was in Dylan John. Dylan obviously made the observations that other than his behavior and the way he acts and looks and everything else, Constantine, I'm sure he's a great guy. But very well done. And Jason Blood shows up, you know, the Demon. They need all the help they get to because they need to find out if Kill-X's soul is still in hell. They're hoping it is because the Joker was trying to use his partnership with that other doctor, Braxis or whatever his name was, to try to resurrect Kill-X. And it looks like the Joker was successful because, alas, they cannot find the soul of this Kill-X character, this serial killer in hell. And so that means that he's been resurrected. And so that's what we have to look forward to. There's a great conversation between the philosopher Epicurus and John Constantine. Epicurus is another philosopher who also believed that that there's a connection between between science and the souls and organic matter. And And so Epicurus advised them that he did, in fact, run into Kilix while Kilix's soul was briefly in hell before the Joker sort of a light pulled him out of the depths of hell. And so it's that's basically the plot. So in other words, not a heck of a lot happens here, but at the same time, enough happens that you're intrigued by it. Because at the first half of the issue is Dylan and Batman having a really good conversation, getting to know each other, building respect for each other, with the goal of saving Groucho, who's the sidekick to Dylan, and saving Catwoman, of course, who's affiliated with Batman. And very well done. Dialogue is fantastic. The Recchione shows he knows these characters. Cavanaugh and Wether Deladera on the art. It really works. This is a lot of fun. And I didn't realize how much I really liked Dylan Dog, because goddamn, he's a slightly nicer Constantine, but he's still kind of in his own way a little bit more to he's probably in the middle ground between being he's not full asshole. Constantine's the full asshole. Dylan Dog is about a hop, skip, and a jump away from being an a-hole. But it was just the right amount that it's kind of interesting. And I love Groucho. I think Groucho is a more entertaining sidekick than Damian is, quite frankly. I could see myself falling in love with Groucho if I was to read more comics with Dylan Dog. And maybe I will. I'm just, this is for a second impression of a character, it's reading pretty good, because I quite enjoy this issue. It was well done.
Yeah, and I hope it is being well received. And, you know, based on Dr. Zabaris, based on Christopher Kalex, it kind of makes me want to read some Dylan Dog. But I don't, mm-hmm. I mean, it's so funny. Like, we talk about it all the time, right? Like, how well comics do in Europe and obviously manga over in Asia, Japan, China, what have you. But a lot of Western comics are translated into other languages, but it's really hard to find other, you know, European comics that are translated into English. Manga obviously has a big market here, but for European comics, like, yeah, you can find it, but it's going to be in Italian. I don't read Italian. So, but I know Dark Horse did do some additions. So I might have to check those out at some point. Anyway, up next we have Green Lantern issue number 10. This is from writer Jeremy Adams. Let me get to the credit. Sorry. The art is by Zermanico and Amon K. Nahelapan, colors by Romulo Fajardo Jr., letters by Dave Sharp. And there is a backup story where we see the return of Omega Bam Man, the wrestler from the wrestling issue of Flash, also written by Jeremy Adams, art by Kevin McGuire, colors by Rosemary Cheatham, and letters by Dave Sharp. So we ended on a little bit of a cliffhanger last time with Hal finally getting to Oa, and the backup story gave us hints that Lord Theranos, who's in charge of the United Planets, may not be on the up and up. And there's actually a rebellion. There's an underground movement for the Lanterns that are looking to overthrow him, I guess you'll say, or remove him from power. They're just trying to find proof and get what they need in order for that to happen. So this one picks up right where that one was where that left off, with Joe Mullen basically explaining to Hal Jordan what's going on and how they're trying to get the dirt on Lord Premier Theros. So what were your thoughts on this?
I thought this was Jeremy Adams has just done a really good job. I continue to be absolutely entertained. It's just we just keep getting the action and it's going somewhere, and I'm getting more and more excited. And I kind of think I know where it's headed, and if I'm right, I'll be super excited. And if I'm wrong, I'll still be excited, because if whatever Jeremy Adams has planned, he's more than established my trust in him over the last few years. But, you know, Hal Jordan has finally made it to Oa, and he ultimately meets up with the Resistance Corps of Oa, consisting of Salak, Joe Mulan, Kyle Rayner, and Baz. And essentially, they find themselves infiltrating the science cells of Oa to rescue Kelly, the Teen Lantern. Because for some reason, Lord Theros, leader of the corrupted leader of the United Planets, he wants to experiment on Teen Lantern. And we're not really sure why, but he's key to their plans. Now, Lord Theros keeps using various pawns to... what he got, I guess his ring hunters. The story refers to the United Lord Theros and his ring hunters, because he sends out, he doesn't call them ring bearers, they're ring hunters, because they go out and they're hunting other ring bearers. And a lot of these ring hunters, they're very fanatical and they're cruel. In fact, one of them even sacrifices himself throwing himself, trying to break through into this emotional barrier. It seems to be some sort of giant, like, glowing bulb of energy, which consists of all the emotional energies of the emotional spectrum. But Lord Theros seems to be trying to gain entrance into this emotional power source, but he can't do it. And every time he keeps throwing his ring hunters into it, they just get vaporized. And so obviously he's trying to find out more information. And Kelly, the Teen Lantern, who's unconscious and doesn't appear to have her gauntlet, the Teen Lantern's gauntlet doesn't appear to be on Kelly, but they try to rescue her, but to no avail. But it's discovered that, much to the delight of Joe Mulan and the other Lanterns, the Lord Theros and the Ring Hunters, they cannot detect Hal Jordan's ring, which is pretty cool, because Joe was surprised to discover that Hal Jordan, because Hal Jordan's ring is powered by that hidden power lamp, that power battery on Earth, you can already see where this might be headed. That if Hal Jordan can give his fellow ring bearers a power ring that's powered by the central power battery located on Earth, their rings will not be able to be shut off by the United Planets. And so you can kind of, I think that's where this is heading at some point, that's what they're going to have to do. Meanwhile, Jessica Cruz continues to be a pretty good spy, who, unbeknownst to Lord Theros, she's feeding information to the Resistance Corps, which is kind of led by Joe Mulan. At least that's what it looks like to me. And it's really cool. And I love how Hal Jordan is reckless here. He's reckless, but in a good way. And there seems to be an unspoken language between Joe Mulan and Hal Jordan. She respects him. And even though at first I thought Hal Jordan was very reckless, the way he just sort of dived in to try to rescue Kelly, the Teen Lantern. But of course, then you realize Hal Jordan likely intuitively knew that it wasn't just recklessness, but it was maybe a little bit of luck. But he also had his own power ring, and it seemed to work. And Lord Theros is now beginning to realize that this Resistance Corps is far more powerful than maybe he originally thought. And they managed to free some other lanterns from the science cells, ones that they want to interrogate to try to find out more information about what Lord Theros' plans are. We know that Larfrees has been incarcerated. They didn't free him, which they should have, because he's extremely powerful. And they say that he even took out half the core when they destroyed his power battery of whatever greed or whatever it is. And in any event, I thought this was great. And then at the end, we find out that the Unseeing, which consists of these three, you know, one warlock and two witches, were utilizing their magics to create a magical barrier around Sector 2814 to prevent various lanterns from entering into that sector of space. And now that they're supposed to focus on bringing in the resistance, which means they're going to weaken the magical barrier around Sector 2814, which might make it easier for Jessica Cruz and other lanterns to, you know, maybe build up an army utilizing the power battery that Hal Jordan will inevitably tell him is located on Earth that he hasn't told them yet about. So you can already see that this is building to probably a pretty cool epic battle. And this could go in so many different directions. I'm really excited about this. And I know, because this was the first comic that I read for this week. When I looked at all that we were going to read, I read this one first. So I was really impressed with it. What about yourself?
Yeah. So there's a world in which in a couple years, Jeremy Adams is going to be like my favorite DC Comics writer of all time. I mean, it's sort of like the closest thing to whether or the closest thing to a situation where you and I are writing the books, right? Like,
yeah.
the ideas that he comes up with, like, he pays attention to continuity, pays attention to things that came before, and he just has really great ideas. Like, I when I'm reading this, I get the feeling that he didn't like the idea of the United Planets and what Bendis did in the pages of Superman any more than we did. And so, you know, right away they were a bureaucracy and things were happening that didn't seem like on the up and up. And now he's turned them out into out and out villain group. And I'm really curious, and I'm going to have to ask Jeremy next time I see him, like, okay, was this your idea to make the United Planets the big bad? Was it DC editorial? Like, what's going on here? You know, off the record, let me know. Because yeah, this is just, it's just fantastic. What's being done here. And I also go back to having Jeremy on when it was announced he was on Green Lantern, and you know, we had him on and he talked about how Hal was stuck on Earth and it was a bit of a challenge because he is such a cosmic character. And you know, I think back to some of my favorite eras of Green Lantern, some of the most well-known eras, like Hard Traveling Heroes, right? Like him teaming up with Green Arrow. That's here on Earth. Or my favorite era, actually, when Hal quit the Green Lantern Corps. I think it was like issue, I don't know, 176-ish or so. And that's when John Stewart got the ring for the first time, and then Guy Gardner eventually in one of the Crisis on Infinite Earths crossovers. Like, I love that era. Dave Gibbons on art, Len Wein writing it. But again, that was all on Earth. That was all on Earth. But yet he is a cosmic character. And, you know, Jeremy had talked about struggling to tell stories and keep him here on Earth, or it being a challenge because you just can't help but want to take him out into space. Well, now Hal's out there. So now I'm curious, there's so many unresolved things that started. Well, I say so many, like obviously the big one is, well, what about Carol? We haven't seen Carol Ferris in a while. Hal seemed like he maybe wanted to be back on Earth, maybe wanted to try to restart that relationship or what have you. So when we get this United Planet stuff or this and this Lantern Rebellion resolved, does he go back to Earth? Does he stay out there? Like, I'm so curious. Like, there's so much going on here. So if anything, as often is the case with Jeremy Adams written titles, I just need more pages. I need more space because yeah. I want more of what Jeremy's doing, which is what we always say about his books. And it's why we're always imploring DC to give the guy more titles, let him write more stuff because he's fantastic. So yeah, I mean, I just love it. All that being said, the backup for me was only okay just because I'm not a big wrestling guy. Like even the Omega Bam Man Flash wrestling issue with what's it called? Wham?
Omega Bam Bam.
Yeah, the wrestling, what is it? Wrestling Association of the Multiverse or something like that.
Right, right. Yeah. Wham. Yeah. W-A-M yeah. For short. Yeah.
Yeah. I just, again, I'm not a fan of wrestling. So, you know, all that, I sort of take it with a grain of salt. I'm sure a lot of people are really going to enjoy it. And that's not to say I didn't enjoy it because it's Kevin Maguire art. It's Guy Gardner. It's Jeremy writing Guy Gardner. So I love all that. I just know I didn't get probably as much of enjoyment out of it as some others might. And it does sort of tie in with what we're going to be talking about later with Action Comics with, I think it's Lobo, but maybe it's not Lobo because all of a sudden there's a bunch of Xenarians that are back that have been brought back by Brainiac. So it was enjoyable. I did get a few chuckles or what have you, but yeah, for someone who's a wrestling fan, I'm sure they're going to enjoy it a lot more. But anyway, any thoughts on the backup?
Just that it's very, very loosely connected to House of Brainiac, the first chapter of which we'll be reviewing this week. And Guy Gardner, who has been sent to try to retrieve Lobo by order of the United Planets, discovers that, in fact, it's, well, it's not really Lobo. He mistakenly thinks it's the main man, but it's not really Lobo. But but he assumes it is because it's a Zarnian. And Guy Gardner is not aware that, I mean, Guy Gardner assumes, you rightly up until recently, that there's only one Zarnian in the universe, and that's Lobo. But there's actually a whole planet of them now because of the House of Brainiac storyline. And so you could forgive Guy Gardner for making that big mistake. And Space Dolphins show up at the end, which I don't know why they showed up at the end, although Booster Gold showed up in this issue of all things, and Skeets conveyed the future to Guy Gardner, and told Guy Gardner earlier in the second or third page, I think it was, that there's going to be some sort of intergalactic event that takes place in that sector of space. And I don't know why the Dolphin showed up there. The last time we saw Space Dolphins was in, I think it was Christopher Priest's Superman Lost run. So I'm not sure where these Space Dolphins come from, but...
Zarnian did whistle. So I'm assuming he called them in some way with the whistle.
Yeah, but I think you're right. Yeah, I think you're right. I always think of Space Dolphins as showing up to rescue people, but I don't think these are going to be friendly dolphins. So. Not the guy, anyway.
And I'm not sure how that whole whistle thing works anyway, because there's no sound in space. But
anyway,
just for the Kevin Maguire art, it's worth the price of admission. So,
yeah.
All right. Up next, I'm not going to have much to say about this particular issue. I say all the time, nobody sets out to make a bad comic. But unfortunately, Speed Force here, issue number 6, which is the final issue. I just don't think it all came together. Just one of those things. Jarrett Williams is a writer, George Kambadas and Tom Derenick on art, colors by Lee Luffridge, letters by AW's Justin Birch, another world's Justin Birch. I know I'm not the audience for this in terms of, you know, video games and kind of slang, teenage slang and what have you, and rap music and whatever. But even beyond that, I think this struggled to find its footing. It struggled to come together. I don't think the art was really strong, because sometimes when you have a book where the narrative is a little on the weaker side, the art can elevate it, right? Unfortunately, the art here, it's not that it's bad, but it's not strong enough to elevate a story that felt a little bit choppy, and it really, more than anything, I think the story, it lacked substance. Everything was sort of on the surface, you know, like you can't make it a plot point and have it have value and be interesting that people are talking in slang. Like, that's just not a thing. Remember how much of an emphasis was put on Wallace West, or Ace, when he was having his hair cut. Like, that was a big plot point in that issue. That's not substance. I can't relate to that. You can't build a story around stuff like that. So I think that there's a lot of good ideas here, but you can't just take a bunch of, okay, well, I want it to be about rap music. I want it to be about teenage slang. I want it to be about haircuts. I want it to be about shoes and apps that young people have on their phone, and young people playing video games, like all interesting ideas that can add sort of context and flavor to a narrative storyline and a plot. But unfortunately, there's not really any plot here, other than falling back a little bit into, oh, there's something wrong with the Speed Force at the beginning, but then it turns out it's not actually the Speed Force at all. It's this app that's mind controlling people, but it was never really explored or explained very well. So unfortunately, this is a situation where the sum is not more than the parts. Just a lot of little ideas, but none of them, like, I think, big enough or of enough depth to carry a story on their own. And even when you put them all together, it doesn't equal a coherent story. If you know what I'm saying, like, you can't just put this is a cool idea, and this is a cool idea, and this is a cool idea. And they're all, again, you know, sort of ancillary ideas. Oh, I'm going to put all these ancillary ideas together and it'll kind of equal one big idea that you can base a comic around. It doesn't work like that. And it didn't work, unfortunately, in the case of Speed Force. So again, nothing against a creative team. I'm sure they tried their best, but for me, this just didn't come together. I just wouldn't recommend anybody ever read this. So that's as nice as I can be. And I'm sorry. Yeah. I feel bad. I feel bad that it just was so, it was such a slog to read and just not enjoyable. So what are your thoughts on it, Rock?
It's like the creative team. There is so much dialogue here, so much superfluous imagery, dialogue, so many unnecessary characters. Booster Gold shows up in this issue for no reason whatsoever. I mean, it's ridiculous. I mean, there's so much of this that just seems like they were trying to do so much for a particular purpose to establish a plot that at the end of the day, I still don't know what's going on. Let me put it to you this way. Near the beginning of this comic, Kid Flash, Wallace West, thinks to himself that the crowd that he's in the concert, the crowd does not know how bad the situation is. And I remember thinking to myself, how bad is the situation? Why are you actually at the concert? What exactly are you trying to do again? I think it has something to do with an app. You're afraid of the music? Are you afraid of the app? Is the app going to take control of the crowd? I'm still a little bit unclear. Not only that, what I found was even more funny, and this was not an intention of the writer. When Booster Gold shows up, Wallace whispers to Booster Gold. He whispers to Booster Gold, and we don't know what he tells Booster Gold, but he's only talking for a few seconds, and Booster Gold immediately leaves because he doesn't want to be there for the bad PR. So in other words, Wallace West he only had maybe 10 seconds to tell Booster Gold what was going on. I would have loved to have heard what Wallace West told Booster Gold in terms of what's going on, because that would have been a perfect opportunity for us readers to be clued in as to what the hell was going on. Because I really don't know. Then at the end, we end up with Tickle and Clarion the Witch Boy is in this at the end. Clarion the Witch Boy out of nowhere. Symphony, Fiddler, what happens to him? Sebastian Stagg. How are these all parts moving together? I don't get it. And then Mr. Terrific's asked at the end if he would like to work with these kids again. And he says yes. And I'm thinking, why? Why? I just don't know. I don't know who this comic book would be for. I would, you know, every now and then I go on the manga website and I read manga, and that's what I'm told the younger kids like. And manga reads, I can understand the attraction of manga, but when I read this, I just don't understand what was being said. There are whole pages where I genuinely don't know what happened or what went on, and it serves no purpose of me reading it again because there's. It's like the writer's trying to impress us with I don't know, like that he knows how kids speak nowadays, but I know of no kids that speak like this. And it's not like I don't interact with them on a daily basis in my occupation I do for a living. So I don't know. I this was definitely a miss for me, and it's unfortunate, but I got to tell you, man, this is, I don't, when I finish reading this, I'm going to, and I have to, I don't want to be overly harsh, but I don't want to see Avery and Wallace West for a long time. I don't want to see them again because I don't want, but I can tell you this, for those people that who read this and share your opinion, Jace, and mine on this series, I can tell you this, the chances of this issue, this series forming part of continuity, I would say are virtually zero, for the simple reason that I don't think future writers will know what the hell happened in these six issues either for them to even want to follow it, even if they wanted to. And that's just the harsh truth.
Yeah, I wouldn't say I don't want to see Avery or Wallace, but I want to see them the way they were written previously, not the way they were written here. But I also, I mean, I don't have a strong affinity for those characters either. But if they're handled like they've been handled in the past, I'd be happy to see them. But yeah, I don't want any more of this kind of tone or context. So anyway, we'll leave it at that. Up next, we have Sinister Sons, issue number 3. This is written by, I thought I was on the credits page, but I guess I wasn't. Written by Peter J. Tomasi. We have art by Vasco Gregev. Tamara Bonvillana handles colors. Rob Leon letters. Bad Sons Rising Part 3. What'd you think?
Well, the last issue ended with the Sinister Sons battling and fighting each other. They were inside Lorzard's spaceship, and it was swallowed by this giant space whale. And within this, they discovered that within this space whale is this character who is apparently called Major Tom. And Major Tom needs to escape the space whale because he's been inside this space whale for a long time. It's sort of like the tale of Moby Dick. And in fact, he's even given it, I think, based on Moby Dick, has even given the whale a name. But in any event, the whole issue is, you know, this was entertaining. I didn't mind it. It was not a heck of a lot happens other than the fact that just more infighting between Lorzod and Sinsun, who basically have to first they basically team up trying to take out Major Tom. And but unfortunately for Lorzod, because they're not near a yellow sun and they're within the belly of the beast of this space whale, he doesn't have access to his superpowers, so he's fairly useless. And this Major Tom character, who doesn't want to harm them because he sees them for children, and they're kind of acting and arguing like kids, he sees that they're not really getting along, and so it's easy for him to sort of make mincemeat out of them. And he's not like a super nice guy. He's willing to leave them there, and because he just wants to take their spaceship and take off and leave. But and that's where Sinsun sort of chuckles under his breath, because Major Tom doesn't realize that, of course, you need voice recognition to run the ship. So Major Tom realizes that he's not going to be able to use the ship to escape the space whale unless he takes Lorzod and Sinsun with them. And as much as he doesn't want to do that, he's going to have to do that. And there's going to be, apparently, I guess, space whale hunters that they're going to confront next issue. And that's the general plot. What's funnier, this was a fun issue. I think Tomasi did a good job. I laughed out loud in a few places. I enjoyed it. What really rammed home for me was just how younger these are. I really got a sense of the youth of Sinsun and Lorzod. Like they feel younger than I would imagine them to be. And there's it's a very different tone, because I can't help, I know I've said this before, I can't help thinking about Neil Before Zod, that series, how dark and gloomy and the tone-wise that is. And here Lorzod is, and he's just a kid, and he's developing a highly dysfunctional friendship slowly with Sinsun. And this Major Tom character is probably maybe a criminal or a thief in his own right. And at some point, tone-wise, how is that going to match up with Sinsun finding out the death of his mother? But in the meantime, this is comedic. It's fun. I think this is going to make for the first three issues. I actually enjoy these first three issues more than a lot of the issues of the Super Sons. Like, I mean, this is getting to the point where I really enjoyed this issue, especially last issue and this issue. I thought it really hit it off. And I want to clarify, when I say I enjoy this more than Super Sons, what I like about Super Sons was I always liked the relationship, because the Super Sons, their relationship with their parents, with their fathers, was always part of, in many ways, part of the story with Superman and Batman, with Damian and John Kent. This here, just for these characters themselves being without their fathers, it's just comedic in a way that I find myself being drawn to them in a way. And it's going to be really interesting to see at some point when Sinestro and Zod show up, if and whenever that happens, the tone of this comic is going to change, I would imagine, very, very drastically. I don't see how it can't change drastically, given what Zod is currently going through in his own series. But I enjoyed this. For its sheer entertainment, Lorzod and Damian Lorzod and Sinsun are just, man, they're birds of a feather, but Sinsen is clearly more intelligent. Lorzod isn't quite as quick. And that was established last issue. Sinsen was very frustrated with Lorzod. I'm surprised at how unintelligent Lorzod is. He doesn't have very good instincts. He relies too much on his powers, whereas Sinsen is a lot more intelligent because Sinsen knew right away that that Major Tom would not be able to escape with the ship. But it took a long time for Lorzod to make that connection. And it's an interesting take because I wouldn't have thought Lorzod to be actually unintelligent. But I guess just because you got superpowers doesn't mean you got super intellect. But in any event, I enjoyed it. What do you think?
Yeah, I'm with you in terms of, I'm enjoying this more than I did the early issues of Super Sons. And part of it is it's the mystery, right? Like you kind of know what to expect with Damian. You kind of know what to expect with John Kent, especially based on who their fathers are. But I don't know what to expect with these two characters, with their relationship, where the story is going to go and what have you. So I also think the art really suits the tone of the story very, very well. And then lastly, I had no idea that Peter J. Tomasi was such a huge David Bowie fan because if you're listening and you're like, wait, he's an astronaut, he's in space, this is Major Tom. And, you know, I think even people that aren't David Bowie fans, you know the line, you know, ground control to Major Tom, this astronaut who, if you listen to the song Space Oddity by David Bowie, this guy's out up there and ground control's trying to call him because his spaceship's malfunctioning and he's too busy awed by space to listen. So I thought that was fantastic. You mentioned the whale as well. Obviously, this whole idea of Moby Dick swallowing things. Major Tom has named the whale Melville. So Herman Melville was the author who wrote Moby Dick, classic in Western literature. So a lot of touch points. I don't know if Peter J. Tomasi is a big fan of Herman Melville or not, but clearly a big fan of David Bowie. So I'm enjoying this. It's very youthful. It's very exuberant. And I can't wait to see where it goes as well. So I echo your sentiments in terms of, Lorzod, a bit of a meathead. Sinsen, obviously, because he didn't have powers, had to rely on his wits. And there's moments in here where you can see them sort of getting along and working together. And then there's moments where they're kind of at each other's throats. It'd be interesting to see what will happen long term. You know, you could see them teaming up. You could see them as a duo for a long, long time. But is it going to be one of those situations where Sinsen's always three or four steps ahead, having to kind of explain things to Lorzod before the light bulb finally goes on? I guess we'll have to wait and see. Up next, we have Batman and Robin number 8, Cult of Man-Bat Part 2 from Joshua Williamson as writer. Nicola Samegio is the artist, Rex Locus on color, Steve Wands on letters. I'm still enjoying what Joshua Williamson is doing here, but I will say that my favorite thing about this Batman and Robin series so far has been the relationship between Bruce and Damian and how it's a little healthier these days, and I'm enjoying that exploration. But unfortunately, we don't get any of that this issue. It's all about Damian having teamed up with Flatline, going after her sister, and there's a couple of plot twists here or there to get the plot where it needs to be. First, it seems like Flatline is on Damian's side, and then she appears to double-cross him. And then when she allows her sister to escape with the weapons that they've got in Gotham City. So basically the whole reason that they're running a weapons ring out of Gotham City is because there's a lot of advanced weaponry there when Batman busts a Two-Face crew or a Mr. Freeze crew or Penguin crew or what have you. So somebody's got to be there to, you know, pick up all the armament and then they ship it out to other parts of the world. And so that's what Flatline Sister's doing. And so as I said, when Damian is there, we saw this at the end of last issue, Damian and Flatline tracking down Flatline's sister. And when Damian is about to attack, Flatline double-crosses him, allows Flatline's sister to escape, going to the docks to ship these weapons out, and hopefully they can escape as well. But then once they get to the docks, then Flatline flips it once again, and she stops her sister from escaping because, come to find out, Flatline has been working with the DEO all along, and she, in order for her sister to get immunity, the deal Flatline made was that her whole rest of her crew would have to be caught. And so that's why Flatline appeared to double-cross Damian when really it was like a triple-cross So pretty interesting. The other part of the issue is Batman working with Shush. But again, I think this issue shines best when Damian and Batman are playing off each other. And because Damian teamed up with Flatline and Batman's teamed up with Shush in this issue, we don't get any of that. But instead, what we do get is Shush claiming, kind of mirroring imaging of storylines here, of Shush leading Batman to Man-Bat's hideout and then trying to claim to Man-Bat once Man-Bat realizes that they're there and Shush has betrayed him. Shush trying to claim, oh, no, no, I did it on purpose. I was bringing him to you so you could take him out. And Man-Bat's not buying it. He ends up taking out Shush and Batman himself. And how that's going to play out, we'll have to wait and see. But it, basically, in terms of how it affects Damian, is his dad's missing. He says that Batman's missing, no word since last night, but this is, you know, hardly the last time he's disappeared while on a mission. But as long as his dad's not there, he's going to go ahead and take it upon himself to investigate his principal, who he thinks is Shush in disguise. I think that's a feint. I think that's a red herring. I don't think she actually is Shush, but she may have a connection to his origin in some other way. I guess we'll have to wait and see. So again, this is enjoyable. It's fast paced, a lot of action. I thought the Semedia art was good, but it's missing my favorite thing about the series so far. This particular issue is, which is, as I said, the play between Damian and Bruce. So, what were your thoughts on this one, Rocky?
I really like the play between Damian and Flatline. I like to see them together again. I particularly love the final full page picture of Flatline entering school. She's looking like we're in the school skirt and probably not the school colors, but she looks somewhat shall we say provocative with her white skin and her longer legs and her and she walks in with Damian and they're gonna check out Professor Stone to see if she is Shush, and it's, you know, I enjoyed that. I would be remiss if I didn't point out cover B. I believe cover B is supposed to be Flatline because she's with her finger on cover B. It looks like she's drawing a Flatline. So I'm sure that's Flatline. I thought maybe at first, maybe it was her sister, Mila. Flatline's real name is Nika. Her sister's name is Mila. Mila apparently has a superpower, but we're not... We're not told what Mila's superpower is, so we still don't know what Mila's superpower is. We know what Nika's is, but we don't know what we know what Flatline's power is. But her sister Mila, what superpower does Mila have? Mila mentioned that her powers manifested when she soon after her sisters did, when her grandfather was killed at their grandfather's funeral, what have you. We still don't know what Mila's superpower is, but presumably it's going to be that superpower that allows Mila to probably escape the custody of the DEO and probably seek revenge on her sister Flatline and Damian, which will be probably throw a hiccup into things. And the other thing which I find kind of funny is I chuckle a little bit at with the lettering of Shush. Every time Shush talks, all the lettering is, it's like faint. Suggesting, are we supposed to believe from the lettering on whenever Shush talks that she talks in a whisper? Because yeah, that's ridiculous. That's just plain stupid. Because why wouldn't Batman, can he hear everything she even says? Does he have enhanced hearing? I guess he does in the Batcave. It's kind of stupid. Like you're talking in a whisper. That's like really dumb. Just really dumb. But in any, that's just a nitpick. I just sort of chuckle. Like, it's a fairly useless trait to have. Oh, look at Shush. You know, what did she say? I have no idea. I can never hear her when she speaks. But in any event, that's a minor nitpick. But I enjoy this issue. I don't mind. I agree with you. Bruce Wayne and Damian have a great rapport. But I think that Damian cares for Flatline. Flatline cares for him. And it's sort of nice to see her show up at his school. And I wouldn't mind if Flatline stayed in Gotham for a while and was a regular and maybe maybe threw a wrench into, or maybe a good third wheel, a welcome third wheel into the Batman and Robin scenario, or maybe the opposite. We shall see. But and I really like the idea of her sister. There's nothing like a little bit of sibling rivalry to screw things up. So all in all, Williamson's been doing a good job in this series, and he's been doing a good job on Superman too. So, you know, kudos to Williamson.
You know, there's a school of thought that says that you should speak in a lower volume of voice when you speak, because it makes people pay attention more. They have to concentrate on what you're saying. I don't know that I necessarily buy into that, but yeah, it'd be great if Batman was like, "Huh? What?
What?
Repeat that? Can't hear you. Did you say something?"
Well, I mean, they're swinging around and they're being attacked, and she's talking in a whisper. I mean, really? Yeah. Come on.
it's pretty. I mean, you get it, right? Shush. Her name is Shush, and yeah. You understand why they're doing it, but. Yeah, in practicality, it's one of those things that it would only work in a comic. Even in live action, it wouldn't work unless you're only watching it at home where you have the closed captioning on, which I know drives some people crazy, but I almost always watch my stuff with closed captioning now. I guess it's a sign I'm older. Anyway, up next, Red Hood, The Hill, issue number 3. Sean Martinborough's the writer, Tony Atkins on art, Matt Herms on colors, Troy Petrie on letters. You know, we've had Sanford Green on art, and you know, I've talked before about how his art style is not really my thing, but I guess I sort of got used to having his art on here because this art, the fact that it wasn't him, it took me out of the story a little bit. It took me a few pages to get used to it. But that being said, I don't have a lot to add in terms of this story beyond what I said last time. So I'll remind everybody in case you weren't listening, I said, I understand why they call this Red Hood the Hill, because Red Hood is a known character and you want to draw in people who are Bat fans. But at the end of the day, this is a procedural about these other characters. The other characters, the inhabitants of the hill, the villains that Martinborough is creating and fleshing out here, that's where the real story lies. But unfortunately, I think if you just put out a DC comic called The Hill, nobody would buy it. But Batman shows up on the last page here. Maybe we'll get some more of him going forward, but we've hardly gotten any Red Hood, and that's fine because the story on its own is interesting. But I get it. Like, I don't have a whole heck of a lot of reason to care about these other what you would say is supporting characters who are actually the main characters in the story. I don't have a lot of reason to care about them because I don't know them. I haven't read enough stories about them yet. So yeah, the jury's still out on this one. But in terms of a technically well done comic, kind of a procedural type comic, you know, exploring good guys and bad guys, crime and villainy or what have you, it's pretty good. It's pretty good. It's good quality storytelling from Sean Martinborough, which doesn't surprise me. You know, I mentioned his artwork on Detective Comics in the past, and he did the art and helped co-write or co-plot the Thief of Thieves title over at Skybound, Robert Kirkman's property. So I'm not surprised that he's doing a great job when he's just handling the writing duties here. The only other thing that I'll say, which I thought, again, was a bit of a nitpick, but I suppose sort of necessary so that you can focus on these supporting characters that are really the main characters in the story, is when Jace meets with Dana here, and he's talking about protecting the hill and what needs to happen. You know, he mentions to her, well, you know, it's kind of up to you and your friends to protect the hill because I'm leaving. I'm not staying, right? That's what he says. I'm not staying. But then the other thing he says right after that is Batman doesn't work this side of Gotham. That was just like, wait, what? Yeah. Batman works all of Gotham. There's no particular, he doesn't stay in particular neighborhoods or whatever. I thought that was like, I get why you're saying it because you want to explain why Batman is not there saving the day. But better to not say anything, I think, and let people just assume, oh, it's because he's out dealing with Failsafe or something, or maybe he's not around. But to specifically call it out like that, it just, that's sort of antithetical to who Batman is, right? Like, Batman's going to try to protect all of Gotham, just like Superman is going to try to protect all of Metropolis. So I just thought that was kind of wonky. But overall, it's a quality story, but it's not a Red Hood story. It's not a Batman story. So just know that going in. What are your thoughts on it?
I enjoyed this issue. This is my favorite issue so far. And I want to compare this issue, and this is going to be a strange comparison, but this is issue 3 of Red Hood, The Hill. And on the very first panel of the first page, we get a scrapbook. And it's basically Killer Croc. He's been hired by Corley Jr. to take out the Watch, which are the good guys. And we get a much needed summary of who all the characters are. Edge, Track, Strike, Block, Wisp. Because I wouldn't have remembered. I appreciate that. And we got images of them. And I appreciate that. I compare that to Speed Force, where I never felt that the writers ever took a break to sort of catch us readers up to speed at any point. And when you don't do that for at any issue, you lose it. So that's a quick passing aside. So much was done in this issue, and it's mentioning, I feel differently than you do about it. I feel that I've gotten to know Edge, Track, Strike, Block, and Wisp in the 3 issues so far. I've gotten to know them more. Their real names, Anna, Gary, and Travis, and there's Denise, and there's Kish, and of course, there's Jason Todd. And, you know, Killer Croc's been hired, and Killer Croc has been hired by Corley Jr., who is this sort of rich rapper slash entertainer who owns a series of retail businesses called God Mode, and he's maybe trying to go legit, but he's got some illegal activity, and he wants to take out the Watch, and Killer Croc recommends that he uses a new character. I think this is a new character, but people can correct me. This correct character goes by Lenny, and he's apparently spent some time. He's sort of a heavier set black character who apparently spent time in Arkham Asylum. That's how Killer Croc knew him. And apparently he's got the ability that when he focuses on something, if you tell him who to focus on, he'll use his projection ability and the person will just end up dead. In other words, he's the perfect assassin, but you would never guess this guy's an assassin. He's just an overweight black kid that, you know, loves having milkshakes and he sits on his couch. But when he falls asleep and whatever he focuses on, whoever he focuses on dies or will be attacked by these creatures. And in this issue, it's all the members of the Watch in their private identities end up getting attacked. And ultimately, Jason Todd fights one off, but Jason Todd and Denise are successful in fighting them off before Batman shows up in their apartment on the final page. But the fates of Anna, Gary, and Travis and Kish are unknown. And so they might be either, maybe one of them will be killed, or we don't know what's going to happen. But I thought this was well done. You know, putting this in perspective, now this originally this series probably hasn't been getting a lot of attention because it did come off on the heels of Joker War. You and I were both critical of that because we're focused on Joker War. Oh my God, not more Joker War. Let's not go backwards. Let's move forward. Quite frankly, in 3 issues, we've gotten a lot of story. There's been character work here, and I think it's been well done by Martin Burrow. Did I say that right?
Yep.
Yeah, Martin Burrow. And I'm actually impressed. And Tony Atkins on the art this issue, I thought it worked. I'm actually interested in this series now. And I'll even forgive the suggestion that Batman doesn't take care of all of Gotham, only because I understand it's clear what the assignment is here, and that is to expand the roster of Gotham City and diversify it a little bit. And it's been successful in that. And to be quite frank, I'm more interested in the Watch than I was in the early stages of a Black Batman, to be blunt. And I think this is the way to do it. And even though it may not have much more in sales, if they got to use Red Hood to give these these potentially interesting characters some attention, so be it. And I really like the villain here, this Lenny. He's sort of an interesting, I'm curious to know exactly how his powers work. It's artistically, it's weird how they seem to work, where he seems to project some sort of image or on these some creatures manifest, and it's odd. I don't know if I quite understand it, but I'm more than willing to wait an issue or two to see, to get that fully explained. But overall, I enjoyed this issue. It's another good comic this week.
Yeah. And I should be clear. I agree with you that we have gotten to know the characters, of the Watch throughout. My point is more like it, other than reading this, you would have no context for these characters, right? As opposed to you put Red Hood title, like, oh, I know who Red Hood is. But yeah, you just put the Hill or call it the Watch or whatever. People are going to go, what's that? So, all right. Up next, we have Action Comics number 1064, written by Joshua Williamson. Art is by Rafa Sandoval, colors by Alejandro Sanchez, letters by Dave Sharp. We're kicking off the big event that House of Brainiac, which is going to lead into Absolute Power. And this is an action-packed issue, so give us your thoughts on this one.
Well, Joshua Williamson, actually, no, it's not Joshua Williamson. Oh, it is Joshua Williamson. Yeah. I liked his approach, how he started this off, because you can tell this is going to be read well as a trade already. At least it's going to start off well as a trade. This is basically Lois Lane has a day off. And Lois Lane, it's like she's so happy. She's happy-go-lucky. She wants to go jogging. And good morning, Metropolis, she says. What could possibly go wrong? And of course, as we're following Lois Lane, as she's jogging, and she says to Metropolis, hope you're ready for me. And we see what each member of the Superman family, what they're doing. Connor Kent, the twins, Kong Kinnon, Kara Zor-El, Lana Lang, Natasha Irons, John Henry Irons, Perry White, Ron Tropy. We see where all these characters, John Corbin, Rudy Jones, Leslie Willis, who's Livewire, Lex Luthor being taken, removed to another part of the prison. I mean, we see all this stuff as Lois meets up with Jimmy and... with Jimmy and his Livewire girlfriend in the park. And then we see Superman. Superman's enjoying the day. It's a beautiful day in Metropolis. Clark Kent shows up, meets with Lois, only to just all of a sudden, boom, we have a massive attack. And we know what it is because we readers have been teased this for a while. It's Lobo, all those billions of Lobos, those Zarnians, I guess, all those Zarnians who are working at the behest of Brainiac are attacking Metropolis. And it's an immediate attack. Superman is the Superman family is overwhelmed. They hold their own, but they're pawns in this game and Brainiac's in charge. Clearly, Brainiac knows what he's doing, but Superman already recognizes that Brainiac is utilizing. It's not like Brainiac to engage in chaos like this. So clearly, Brainiac is thinking differently. Whatever Brainiac's endgame is here, we don't know what it is. And we got to bear in mind that even though we know that in Absolute Power, at some point, Brainiac will be teaming up with Failsafe and Amanda Waller. At this point, we don't know that. We just know that Brainiac is attacking mindlessly, creating chaos in Metropolis by having a bunch of Zarnians attack Metropolis. Why is he doing that? What's the end game? We got other revelations here. We know that the artificial, the AI construct that runs Supercore that we thought was so funny because it was in the image of Lex Luthor is actually, of course, controlled by Brainiac. And we know that Lena herself, and you pointed this out right away, I mean, she's got a history with Brainiac, but Lena Luthor has got the triangle indentation on her head being a symbol of Brainiac. She, of course, is kidnapped by Brainiac. Luthor is attacked by the Zarnians. Luthor manages to barely survive. Superman manages to, Superman manages, of course, to survive, of course, but not until various members of his family are essentially they're kidnapped or they're apprehended or zapped away by Brainiac and Kenan Kong, Connor Kent, Kara, his cousin. They're all basically taken off, and the twins. Brainiac has them, and before Superman can make it to Brainiac's ship, which is orbiting Earth, it disappears. And so, what is Brainiac up to? We don't know, but we know that somehow Luthor at some point in the past, surprise, surprise, provided certain information to Brainiac that Brainiac is now utilizing to his advantage in his machinations, the full scope of which we don't know. But I got to tell you, man, I'm I'm invested. Williamson, you did a good job. This is an adrenaline rush of an issue. This is how you want to start off an event. It started off, it was a beautiful day, and it's ruined by a supervillain attack. fantastic art. Man, who is the, I didn't write down the artist. Who's the artist?
Rafa Sandoval.
Rafa Sandoval, yeah, fantastic art. And at the end, all these different versions of Brainiac at the end, which is very interesting, because at some point, it's a little bit, we're going to end up, I understand from solicitations that there's a queen Brainiac somewhere, but these all look like male Brainiacs. So why are there so many Brainiacs? I don't know. Are there Brainiacs from the different areas of the multiverse? I don't know. What do the Zarnians have to do with this? What's the end game of Brainiac? I don't know, but I'm excited to find out. And I haven't, you know, I don't know what, I'm excited to read part two next week. And I'm invested in this story already, and I think it's been a pretty good setup. Williamson's done a good job planting the seeds, and I really like the biggest surprise to me was the AI construct being in control of Brainiac. I never saw that coming. So kudos to Williamson. He planted some seeds here and he managed to surprise me with some pretty interesting misdirections, and I'm curious to see where it goes. And yeah, I'm quite happy with this opening issue to this event. What about yourself?
Yeah, did you ever see that movie, Reign of Fire? It has Christian Bale in it and Matthew McConaughey, and dragons come back and like they've burned the world and what have you.
They come back. I recall it vaguely, but not enough to in terms of a plot point. So
in that movie, Matthew McConaughey, maybe in his most unrecognizable role, has a completely shaved head and this big, huge, bushy beard. And he's like dirty and, very unkempt. And when I saw General Chakal in this issue, immediately called back to Matthew McConaughey in that movie, which I thought was kind of funny. But yeah, you're right. This is the way you start an event. Even more so than the line work by, Rafa Sandoval, I thought that the color work was done really, really well. I mean, so often with Brainiac, you know, you think of the purple and you think of the green, but that purple, it really pops off the page from Alejandro Sanchez, where it really does look like it's glowing. That whether it be in the Brainiac triangle on his forehead or when he's on a ship, various things that are glowing that pink purplish color. I mean, it really does look, you know, lit from within. Also being able to see Lana Long in her Superwoman persona, you know, although very briefly, is fantastic. A real reminder here by Joshua Williamson of that it's a Superman family now, which, you know, we sort of have taken issue with at times, but it certainly works for what's happening here because they've all been taken off the playing field, as you alluded to, except for Superman himself. They've all been captured. So how he's going to save them, we'll have to wait and see. It does seem at one point that maybe the Zarnians are a little more powerful than we realize, a little more of a match for Superman. But really, he's just trying to gather information. He was playing possum. And then once he finds out what he needs to know, it seems like he's able to overcome them pretty quickly. But strength in numbers, right? We know there's a ton of Zarnians, and you mentioned the army of Brainiacs we see on the last page. So he's going to have his work cut out for him for sure. But as much as I've enjoyed some recent events in Superman, whether it be War World or the Blue World story that we had after that from Philip Kennedy Johnson, those felt sort of like treading new ground, like building new mythos for Superman. This feels like a throwback to old Triangle era Superman events with villains that we're used to right now. Maybe back then it was the Vindicators or the Coons as opposed to the Zarnians, because there was only one at that time, right? Lobo. But in terms of it being Brainiac, in terms of supervillain team up, in terms of seeing characters like Perry White and Ron Troop and that sort of thing, and feeling like a big interconnected story, that's what this feels like. Little bit of a throwback Superman event, and I am here for it. I'm so excited. What I hope is that, you know, based on the fact that it's Joshua Williamson, based on the fact we have the Absolute Power event coming up soon, And Williamson has been so involved with kind of architecting the DC universe lately, although I think he's taken a step back from that a little bit. What I hope is that this story has a chance to kind of stand on its own and breathe and play out the way that it should, and that it's not interfered with or in some ways adapted to lead into absolute power, which I've kind of heard rumors about that. You know, it's fine if it leads to it in some way, but I just want to make sure that this can stand on its own. Like if somebody has no interest in absolute power, can't stand Amanda Waller, is not going to read it or whatever, that you can still read this House of Brainiac story and get the complete story without having it dovetail into anything else. But I guess we'll have to wait and see how that all plays out. The Rafa Sandoval line work is fantastic to go along with Alejandro Sanchez color work, because there's a lot of action here and a lot of characters. So, you know, perhaps that's why he hasn't been on the last few issues of Action Comics. He's working on this. I hope that's the case. I hope he had a chance to work ahead a little bit, because his line work is fantastic. Yeah. All right, on to the last book we're going to talk about in detail. It's Batman and Robin and Howard Part 2 by bestselling author Jeffrey Brown. He handles the writing and the art. Colors are by Silvana Briss. This is, as we mentioned last time, aimed more at the young adult reader. It's from the young adult line. Batman and Robin and Howard was a young adult graphic novel. They're splitting it up into four issues and releasing them as single issues. And again, we talked about it the first time. We talked about issue one, how it really is a way to get younger readers interested in Batman and Robin. It's a little more of a simple story. There's Damian is at this new school. He's the smartest kid in class, with maybe the exception of this Howard individual who previously was the smartest kid. Now there's a bit of a rivalry between the two of them in the classroom to answer questions and kind of show off their knowledge, as well as a rivalry on the soccer field, because Howard previously was the best player on the team. And now him and Damian are sort of battling for supremacy, if you will, on the soccer field. So it's a lot of fun. I think it's very relatable probably for young readers. And the art is a very animated or cartoon type style from Jeffrey Brown, but it really kind of suits the tone of the story, as does the lettering. So, this is just fun and lighthearted, and obviously you don't need to have read anything other than the first issue of Batman and Howard to jump on board with this. So definitely recommend it for younger readers. What are your thoughts on it, Rocky?
Yeah, no, I agree with you. It's good for younger readers. It's not, you know, it's obviously not something that that's for me. Although my retailer, sometimes he's kind enough, he puts them in my pull box for to give to my daughter. So who knows, I might even expect to get this second issue like I got the first. So this is, we need comics like this, because it, at least in theory, I like to think that there's new readers out there. And, you know, I guess you got to start get readers as young as you can, and hopefully they'll stick with the medium as they get older, because the idea that comic books, you know, we're a dying breed, where the population of the whole planet seems to be decreasing, particularly in North America. It's the idea that, you know, the comic book fan base needs to increase somehow. We got to get them while they're young. So,
Yeah, exactly. Well, that does it for all the books we're going to talk about in detail. That is all the single issues coming out this week, but there are some collections. We've got Detective Comics Volume 4, Riddle Me This, collects Detective Comics issues 159 through 1061. Then we've got The Flash by Joshua Williamson, Omnibus Volume 1, which collects The Flash Rebirth 1, The Flash numbers 1 through 35, Batman 21 through 22, which are those button crossover issues, Hal Jordan and the Green Lantern Corps 32, Justice League 32 and 33, and material from the DC Holiday Special 2017. So it's gigantic. It's a ton of material from Williamson's run. So over 1,000 pages, if you are so inclined. And then we've got Tales of the Teen Titans, which includes Tales of the Teen Titans 1 through 4, which sets up Beast World, and those are the four different issues that we had, each by different writers. I think we had one was focused on Starfire, another one was on Donna Troy, another one was Cyborg, and I think the last one was Beast Boy. So if you're curious about that, check it out. They're all four issues collected together there. And then we've got DC versus Vampires Volume 2, which collects DC versus Vampires 7 through 12, which was co-written by James Tynan and Matthew Rosenberg. And then the last collection is The Vigil trade paperback 1 through 6, written by Ram V, which Rocky and I both really, really enjoyed. Highly recommend that one. So yeah. So those are the collections that are out this week. What's your pick of the week, Rocky?
This was particularly difficult for me, but I have to make a decision. It is I continue to enjoy Batman First Night. I enjoyed The Outsiders. I love Batman Dylan Dog. I love Green Lantern 10. I loved Action 1064. And it was my favorite issue of Red Hood in the Hill so far. And even Batman and Robin, I like. So damn. But at the end of the day, it's so refreshing to have a big event start off on the ground floor running an adrenaline rush. I'm going to go with Action Comics. I got to go with Action Comics because I don't always sing Williamson's praises, but you know, I wasn't a big fan of the last big event he did with Dark Crisis, but I really like how this one's starting off. And so I'm going to go with Action Comics, but probably with Green Lantern a close second. But what about yourself?
Yeah, I mean, really hard not to pick Green Lantern, right? Because you're right, it was really fantastic. I thought Outsiders was great as well, but and Action Comics, like you said, really a great way to start an event. But I got to go with the Batman First Night Book 2. The artwork is fantastic. Being able to go back and flesh out the earliest days of Batman set in that time frame when he did first appear, I think is just fantastic. The color work by Mike Spicer. I mean, that creative team, Dan Jurgens and the two Mikes, are just putting together something really special. And maybe a little bit of an advantage art-wise because a little more real estate on the larger Black Label pages. But Mike Perkins and Mike Spicer are using it to its full potential. So I got to go with that. It wasn't
good choice.
It wasn't even really close, to be honest. like I said, Green Lantern was fantastic as well. So that's going to do it for this episode, everybody. Appreciate you joining us as always. Any last words there, Rocky?
This is the second week in a row where I really, really enjoyed the comics. I was, you know, other than Speed Force, but I mean, really everything else I enjoyed, and even Outsiders has been sort of a schizophrenic ride for me, but Outsiders I think is one of those wild card comics that I enjoyed the hell. The whole Grant Morrison meta aspect of that is, you know, and even Suicide Squad, Nicole, you know, Amanda Waller. I mean, God, I'm really curious. I'm asking, I got all these crazy questions about where the DC universe is going. Like you said about Brainiac, is the Brainiac attacking? It's got to lead to Absolute Power, surely. Is he already working with Amanda Waller? He's 10 steps ahead. What's going on there? What's Amanda Waller? Is she being mind controlled? Is she just, you know, is she genuinely turning evil? Is this a genuine turn? I don't know. What's Failsafe going to be doing? Because he's part of that trio of Absolute Power and the villains. I mean, I gotta say, all around, I'm much more positive about DC where this is headed than not. And so far, I mean, yeah, I'm smiling more than I'm frowning, which is good.
Yeah, 100% agree. So, all right, that's gonna do it, everybody. Appreciate you joining as always. Don't forget, head over to YouTube, subscribe to Rocky's channel, Comic Space, boom, !! Ring the notification bell, leave some comments below. You know what to do. Conversely, if you're checking us out on YouTube and you want to go back and listen to some content, interviews, convention coverage, or what have you from the Comic Source podcast, the audio only feed. Just go to wherever you get your podcast, do a search for the Comic Source and subscribe. You have over 2,000 episodes to explore. So we appreciate the support as always, everyone, and we'll talk to you next time.
Catch you later.
You can find the Comic Source podcast on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Google Play, or whichever podcasting app you prefer. Please tell all your friends about us, subscribe, and rate us. The ratings really help with our visibility and our ability to reach new listeners, especially 5-star reviews on Apple. Also, be sure to visit us at lrmonline.com to join the conversation, access the show notes, and discover all our other great pop culture content. If you want to email us, the email address is thecomicsourceblog@gmail.com, or you can follow us on Twitter, twitter.com/thecomicsource. Do a search for The Comic Source on Facebook and Instagram to follow us on those social platforms. All three spots are great places to find out when we release new episodes, as well as follow all our convention coverage. So once again, we want to thank everyone for listening, and we'll talk to you next time.